see.
Okay, so what I tried to do was to break down to break down the last few weeks into just seven discrete sections. I'll try to cover them all today, and then, you know, if there's anything outstanding, then tomorrow we could pick up on it. And obviously, if there are any questions about the last 6 weeks or so, just don't hesitate. So one of the things that we focused on at the beginning of the series was the we called the roots of the Akedah, and we noted that it was really a double or a dual nisayon. The Torah describes it as v'halukim nisayas Avraham. We spoke about the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which says that Avraham had been tested 10 times in his life, and this was the culmination of all of that. Why was this such a test from the perspective of Avraham? So we listed a couple of reasons. Obviously, it required incredible discipline simply to execute, incredible faith to carry out, but more to the point, the aspect of self-sacrifice. Avraham had given his life for the ideal of understanding everybody as created in the image of a all-powerful God, and that obviously implied a certain level of ethical conduct, and to be asked to behave in a way that seems to be a violation of the most basic principle of ethical conduct, killing an innocent, let alone an innocent who's one's own family member, was a remarkable test for him. Moreover, separating the ethical moral challenge out, there is a personal familial challenge. After all, Avraham had waited a very long time for a descendant who would be his heir. He had been essentially told or forced to exile his presumptive heir, right, Yishmael, before this. So now, on a personal familial level, there's a great sense of disappointment and letdown after waiting 100 years for Yitzchak as his heir. So on those two levels, we argued that the test for Avraham was well beyond being asked to give his own life. Giving his own life would have preserved both his moral legacy as well as his actual familial legacy. So that is a very important aspect of the test as far as Avraham goes. But nonetheless, right, we noted it's also a test for Yitzchak. Yitzchak was not incapable of resistance. He was highly capable of resistance, and he certainly could have either run away or physically resisted. And as we noted, there's a lot of evidence in Chazal that, you know, Vayelchu Shneihem Yachdav, Zel Lishchot, this one to perform the act, Zel Lishachet, this one to be sacrificed. The language that we found in Chazal of Yitzchak insisting to Avraham that he be bound very tightly and very well so that he wouldn't resist, even against his own will, sort of in like a natural instinct of self-defense. All of these things point to the fact that you can't speak about the Akedah as having one hero, but really two heroes. Furthermore, we noted that the Vayihi Achar HaDvarim Ha'ila seems to speak to the fact that both Avraham and Yitzchak in certain sense, asked for this kind of a challenge, right? Remember, we saw the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and the Medrash Rabbah, it says that Avraham, that I just made this whole big party upon Yitzchak's birth, Vayas Avraham Mishteh Gadol, and he didn't offer a proper korban, and then, of course, the response is, don't worry, you'll offer the ultimate korban. And as far as Yitzchak's concerned, there's this kind of a competition between Yitzchak and Yishmael. Right, Yishmael says, I had the bris milah at 13. You know, what did you really sacrifice? You were 8 days old. You didn't know any better. You weren't in a position to resist anyway. And Yitzchak said, I'm prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice. You are boasting about your bris milah. I'm prepared to go much further. The point of all these midrashim is that both Avraham and Yitzchak had a stake and had a heroic stake in the Akedah. Okay, so just moving on to the next the next major topic that we covered is that Avram's response is becomes like a calling card in Torah. Avram says, Hineni. Rashi says, Hineni is Lashon Anivus. It's a language of humility, not like, you know, here I am, I'm going to be the hero in self-aggrandizing way, but on the contrary, a very humble statement, but also lashon zrizus, a sense of readiness, a sense of alacrity. And Avram's using that term, hineni, is mirrored at later stages by Yaakov and by Yosef. They try to embody that. So as we're about to start Sefer Bereishis over again, keep that in mind. Every time you see hineni, it's sort of a channeling of Avram's great statement at the Akedah. We also know that there are some pretenders, right? That Esav also tries to use that, right? And when he is asked by his father to go out into the field and prepare a blessing, the korbanos for a blessing, and then Bilam himself says, you know, the term hineni, a little bit of a different conjugation, but the same idea. So hineni will always be a litmus test. Who really walks in the footsteps of Avram, and who is a pretender entirely? Then we also noted Avram's greatness is that he can say both hineni to Hashem, but also hineni vni to Yitzchak in the context of the Akedah, that Yitzchak, he doesn't have to turn his back on Yitzchak even as he's being ever-present for Hashem. Now most people, to fulfill Hashem's commandment at that stage, would have to steel themselves completely and sort of cut themselves off internally from the emotions of being a father. So Avram doesn't do that. He's able to somehow synthesize within himself both saying hineni to Hashem and hineni vni to his son, which is all part of what makes him so remarkable. Okay. Lech lecha el eretz ha-Moriah. Avram is told to go to the land of Moriah, and this, of course, becomes the site or location of the Beis HaMikdash. So this set us up for our main thesis, which is that the entire edifice of Mikdash and Korbanos is built on the location, not randomly or arbitrarily, but it's really the house that Abraham built. Of course, he didn't build it in the sense that David or Shlomo built it, in the physical sense, but his act consecrated that place as the place that was most fitting for the Beis HaMikdash. It's called Eretz HaMoriah, and Chazal say Moriah, linguistically, that becomes Misham Teitze Hora'al Yisrael, Misham Teitze Yir'al Yisrael. It's from that location that the Torah will ultimately go forth. It will become the house of the Sanhedrin. It's from that location that the Mikdash will eventually be built. We noted that there's a mitzvah in the Torah. One of the 613 commandments is to have Yiras HaMikdash, to have a sense of awe of that place. We try to argue that the Yiras Shamayim that Avram demonstrated, Hashem says to Avram in the aftermath of the Akedah, now I know that you are God-fearing, Ata Yadati Ki Yirei Elokim Ata, this becomes the genesis of the mitzvah of Yiras HaMikdash. And, you know, Jacob, you actually mentioned this at the time, right? It's not from the physical structure that you have, but the one who dwells in that structure, right? Yiras HaMikdash is really just a way of saying Yiras Hashem B'Mikdash. Okay. We spoke at length before Rosh Hashanah about the dichotomy of Ahava and Yira, following up on this, demonstrated at the Akedah. Avram is described by the Navi Yeshayahu as the ultimate lover of God. Zera Avraham, you are the Jewish people, the offspring of Avram, Ohavi, the one who loves me. So Avram is called the ultimate lover of God. The Rambam in Sefer Mitzvah says that Avram's love of God is expressed by the fact that he wishes to share his love of God with others. That a person who's a great lover of someone or something deeply desires that that someone or something should be appreciated by the larger public. In other words, let's just use a mashal in the opposite direction. We all love Israel. It's very painful to all of us when we see the kind of unjust scorn heaped on Israel. It's something that isn't just wrong. We don't perceive it as incorrect or an injustice, but it bothers us because we love Israel. So in the inverse direction, right, Avram, who was a great lover of God, sheyehei shem shamayim misayiv al yadecha. On the other hand, Avram isn't just called the great lover of God, he's also called, in this context, the one who is in complete awe of God. Ata yadati ki yirei Elokim ata. So what we try to explain is that even though you would think that these are separate ideals, and in fact, in the Rambam, they're categorized as two distinct of the Tariq mitzvos, in other words, they're not one and the same, yet they seem to have some kind of relationship. It's just remarkable that Avram becomes the paradigmatic embodiment of both. So we read from the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, when the Rambam said that, in fact, the process, or the means through which one attains Ahava and Yira, is inextricably linked. So that's very important. It's not intuitive. You wouldn't get that impression from the Sefer HaMitzvos. In the Sefer HaMitzvos, Ahava and Yira are different. Ahava is expressed by studying the Torah, seeing the indescribable depth of each and every one of the mitzvos, and as such, being propelled to want to become close to God. In the Sefer HaMitzvos, Yira Shamayim is described as a fear of consequences, and yet in the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam links it to. Anybody remember in what sense they're linked? In other words, how is the means towards Ahava and Yira singular? This is where exactly the Rambam says, mostly one has to contemplate all of these sciences, creation. So through reflection upon that, one is filled with a deep love of God, but then Miyad, the Rambam says, Nirta le'achorav. You're sort of projected backwards with great distance because one can't help but realize the vast chasm between his, as the Rambam calls it, Briash Fela, Afela, Chashecha, the smallness of one's mind, Lefnei Tmim Deos, in front of one whose mind encompasses it all. We noted that it's so important that the Rambam develops his notion of Yira from fear of consequences, just a sense of awe, because this helps explain in what sense that Avram is a Yare Shamayim at the Akedah. In other words, if it were merely the fear of consequences, there's simply no reason that Avram would have carried this out. There are no consequences worse than having to kill off the son that he sees as his heir, that will be his heir, Ki v'yitzchak yikare l'chazara, and destroying his moral legacy. In other words, Avram's advocacy for Sdom, his great personal kindness, will be meaningless. You could just see the newspaper article, right? It's as if, God forbid, a great humanitarian was exposed as a fraud, as somebody who was funding a genocide in Africa, right? It would undermine whatever their legacy had been up until that point. If Avram, the great humanitarian, had been seen to literally murder his own son, so that would have undermined it all. So it wasn't a question of the fear of consequences so much as a sense of awe and having to submit his small intellect and to submit that to Tmim Deos, one whose understanding just simply goes so far beyond his own. And that was the type of Yira that the Akedah demonstrated. Not the fear of consequences, but what we call the Yiras HaRomimus. So that would be the special Ahava and Yira demonstrated in the context of the Akedah. Now to turn a little bit to the halachic legacy of the Akedah. We noted that there appears to be a very surprising position that the Rambam takes, that one must use the shofar of an ayil on Rosh Hashanah. There doesn't appear to be great evidence for this in the Gemara itself. The Gemara debates whether or not one could use even a straight horn, not from an ayil. And even if we assume that one has to use a bent horn, there's no evidence in the primary sugya in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Chafav that we discussed that would suggest it has to be of an ayil. Okay, it may be the ideal, and in fact, almost all of the Rishonim consider it an ideal. So the Ravid says it's an ideal. The Tur says it's an ideal. And yet the Rambam, and to a certain extent this is adopted by the Shulchan Aruch, or the Shulchan Aruch is working off the Rambam says that the real mitzvah of shofar, and the Rambam takes it even further than the Shulchan Aruch ultimately would, that you must use the shofar shel ayil. So why would that be the case? So certain super commentaries on the Rambam assume it's because of what appears to be a relatively, I wouldn't say legal Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, but more like a description. Amar Rabbi Avahu, this is the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Tzayin. Why do the Jewish people have a custom of using the shofar shel ayin? Bipnei ma token b'shofar shel ayin? Shel ayil?
Amar Ribono Shel Olam, Tiku Lefanai B'Shofar Shel Ayil, Kedei She'ezkor Lachem Akedas Yitzchak Ben Avraham. So that I remember the Akedas Yitzchak.
So again, the Rambam took this Gemara apparently very seriously, and felt that the only way to achieve the kind of mitzvah that we're looking for in Rosh Hashanah of shofar, of Shmias HaShofar, is the shofar Shel Ayil, rooted apparently in Akedas Yitzchak. So that's a really remarkable halachic legacy of the Akedah, if it's true. Again, most Rishonim don't agree. Most Rishonim say maybe the ideal, but even on that level, the fact that the Akedas Yitzchak represents a kind of a lechatchila and needs to be understood. So what we try.
Why would Hashem need a mnemonic?
Right.
He does.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's a very important question in general. Like that we. We speak about Hashem as Ein Shich. Ein Shich. Nathan is saying, look, we say it many times on Rosh Hashanah, Ein Shich Chalif Nei Kiseich Vodecha. There is no such thing as God forgetting. So, what does it really mean? What does it symbolize? So, we tried to explain at the time is that if you go back to the actual scene that's described in the Torah, the ram is caught in the bush. Okay, so the ram is caught in the bush not by its foot and not by its tail and not by its leg, but by its horn. Ne'echaz basvach bekarnab. So that if you wanted to extricate the ram, what you would have had to do is either somehow right, so the easiest way to do it would be
grab the ram by the horn.
Right, to take the ram by the horn, exactly. So that separating the horn from the ram would have set the ram free. We quoted at the time of the Yerushalmi in Maseches Tanis, which speaks about the ram being a kind of a metaphor. Atidin banecha lehistabech be'avonos. That your children, Avram, Hashem says to him, will be ensnared, enmeshed, just as this ram is enmeshed in the bush, they will be enmeshed in sin. And the process of going through Rosh Hashanah is actually a process of extrication. So, if you think about it, if the ram is meant to be a kind of a metaphor, according to the Yerushalmi, so then the simple way of extricating the ram is to take the horn, and the ram goes free, right? The only thing which is stuck in the bush now is the, right, is the horn. So the idea seems to be, building it all together, that taking the shofar shel ayil on Rosh Hashanah is a way of setting one free, right? If the ram, asidin banachal histabech bavonos, that it's not really the ram who's caught in the svach, but it's all of us.
What kind of bush are we talking about that it's easier to saw off a ram's horn?
Right, it's really just an image. Yeah. It's just a svach. We don't know what it is exactly, but it was it was so ensnared that even the Medrash and the Gemara describe the ram as running back and forth, but he simply can't pull himself out. The horn is stuck but good, right? So the idea appears to be one of.
It's also something that probably helps to remind us.
Oh yeah, that's the point for sure.
Hashem, but reminds us of that experience. That frame of mind.
Commitment.
Right.
The commitment demonstrated.
It's like, wearing the gold clothing, is in Kategor Nasasnegor. I mean, we don't want to remind ourselves of that experience, so we kind of want to focus on a different
thing. And ultimately, that's probably always the case with Zichronos. But Hashem sees that we remember, right? So then that, Hashem seeing that we remember is some, is something very important. We noted that it's not a surprise that the theme of liberation or extrication is such an important one on Rosh Hashanah. After all, the basis of using a shofar on Rosh Hashanah is from the Yovel. There is no pasuk in the Torah that says, use a shofar on Rosh Hashanah. It says, make a truah. But in the context of Yovel, we're told, you are supposed to blow a shofar, truah, and what happens on Yovel is things are liberated, right? The slaves are liberated, the land goes free. There's this process of starting anew. So the theme of liberation and extrication is really inherent to the shofar. We noted the next major halachic legacy of the Akedah was felt in the realm of Kachim, of Mikdash. And here we had many different data points. So there's a great emphasis within Chazal on Avram's role as a Kohen. That if Avram was going to offer this korban, he best be a Kohen. Remember we said that even Moshe, when Moshe uttered the term Hineni, Hashem says, wait a second. You're not Avram, at least not yet. And don't say Hineni l'kahuna, Hineni l'malchus, because that's anyway. Al divrasi malki tzedek, Avram became the
Kohen in place of Malki Tzedek. Malki Tzedek was Kohen Lekel Elyon, but Avram took his status over. We noted that Yitzchak had to be a perfect aisle, the perfect korban. That's why he said, tie me up really well. I don't want anybody to blemish me. And as a matter of fact, that's an idea that we carry through. The last time we see Yitzchak in this section of the Torah is when he's being tied up. He's never actually released in the Psukim. Obviously, we know that he had to at some point been released by his father. But the fact that the Torah doesn't describe that is very important, because it's the Torah's way of saying that for the rest of his life, Yitzchak will always be the Ola Tmima. He will be a permanent korban, and therefore he's not really released from there. And Yitzchak is referred to throughout our liturgy as Temuras Ayil, the one who is replaced by the Ayil. He is a korban. When you have a Temura, it's not, meaning when you replace korban A with korban B, korban A doesn't lose his status. Korban A is still considered a korban, right? And when we call Yitzchak Temuras Ayil, it's a way of saying, yes, the Ayil ultimately was brought, but Yitzchak is still Kadosh. That's why Chazal explained he was not allowed to leave the land of Israel. All of that emerges from the fact that Yitzchak really stayed very much within the framework of the Akedah. His personality is shaped in a very definite way by the experience of the Akedah. We noted the Gemara in Zmachem on Samach Beis says, how did those who returned from Babylonia in the context of Ezra and Nehemiah know where to build the Mizbeach? There was no definite archaeological evidence. And it says, there are three opinions in the Gemara, one of them, that of Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, is that they saw the ashes of Avram's, korban of Yitzchak in that place. In other words, literally the very foundation stone of the Mizbeach, of the altar, is the ashes, the remaining ashes of Yitzchak Avinu. It's a way of saying that there would be no Mizbeach were it not for what was offered initially at Har HaMoriah. There is a mitzvah in the Torah, one of the 613 mitzvahs, is to bring a korban ola, a burnt offering, on Har HaMoriah three times a year, the Ola Sri'ya, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. And you're supposed to literally walk up, it's called Ola L'Regel, you're supposed to walk up to the Beis HaMikdash with a korban ola. One can't help but think that the roots of this Aliyah L'Regel, of walking up to Har HaMoriah with a korban ola, right, the first time that happened is obviously at the Akedah. And we speculated that might be the basis of the machlokes between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai about how old or how young does your child have to be to participate. They're not obligated until their bar mitzvah, but there is a mitzvah of chinuch. So, for example, we're going to have sukkah. So from what point is a father obligated to buy his son a lulav? From the point that his child knows how to shake the lulav. That's what the Gemara says. Katan yodea l'naneya. Okay, it's actually already a Mishnah. So what is the status as far as Ola the Regal? So Beis Shammai says really young, as long as, how old was Josh when you could carry him on your shoulders before Lisa would flip out, let's say?
Two.
Very young, right. Okay, so two, right. You don't have to be that old to go on your dad's shoulders. So that's what Beis Shammai says. The father has to be able to walk with the son. The son doesn't need to be able to walk. Beis Hillel says the son has to be able to walk independently. He can hold his father's hand, doesn't have to be able to walk. So what does that mean? So we thought, okay, you could just say that's because the child has to be Ola the Regel also. The other possibility is Vayelchu Shnehem Yachdav, as the Torah says about Avram and Yitzchak. Then we noted, if that were true, that would be really awesome, because there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Dalet, which seems to say, how do we know, this is not the way that all Rishonim interpret the Gemara, but let's say the Ramah, how do we know that somebody who's blind in one eye is not obligated to perform the mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel? So the Gemara says, because Yireh Yera'eh. Just as one has to yera'eh, appear before God, be seen by God, so too one must see God. Just as one is seen by God clearly, one has to see God clearly. We obviously can't see God in the physical sense, but to see God clearly means to have both eyes functioning. Why do we say that yira'eh yera'eh? So the way the Ramah interprets the Gemara is because vayikra b'ham shem ha'makom ahu Hashem yira'eh asher yamir hayom behar Hashem yira'eh. Yeah, go ahead, Nathan.
The new technology out of Israel that uses the auditory part of the brain to help people who are blind to see, using that muscle and signals from the ear to be able to give images to people who are blind. So it might be in Hashem's infinite wisdom that even people who are technically blind would be able to see with another capability that Hashem gave them.
Certainly a kiyum, it certainly would be a fulfillment, right? Even if you couldn't formally obligate, there would be a kiyum. That's very good. They could participate. Okay. The next thing that we saw is the Gemara in Zvachim, the Gemara in Chulin, the Gemara in Menachos, three different Gemaras which said that Avram's use of a ma'acheles, a kind of a knife, at the Akedah became the basis for the requirement to use a knife when one does shechita, both in the context of ritual offerings, kachim, as well as just in general with shechita. So that was really fascinating, that Avram's korban is being seen as the prototypical korban as far as this halacha goes. That, you know, this had, the Akedah had halachic impact in all generations, both in the realm of kachim as well as the realm of chulin. And we noted that Rabbeinu Tam kept on going back and forth, you know, like, to what extent is the Akedah a model for kachim or chulin? On the one hand, it had the status of an ola. On the other hand, it wasn't a typical ola because it was a human ola, and that's not typical. But anyway, the duality of the Akedah being both a template for ritual, kachim, as well as non-ritual chulin offerings was a very important idea. The last two halachic legacies of the Akedah had to do with the use of an ayil. If Yitzchak was, so to speak, replaced by the ayil, so then we have a very tantalizing, though admittedly a very ambitious thesis, namely that every time you find a korban ayil as an ola in the structure of Mikdash, maybe that is kind of the imprimatur of the Akedah, what we're meant to channel is. So again, in every holiday you have an ayil le'ola. And in many private offerings, the private offering of Aharon on Yom Kippur, you have an ayil le'ola. The private offering of each one of the princes in the inauguration of the Mishkan was an ayil le'ola. Even Bilam tried to offer an ayil le'ola seven times over. And we found in each one of those last three cases, the princes, Bilam, and Aharon's personal offering on Yom Kippur, formulations in Chazal saying that this was the channeling of the ayil offered by Avram at the Akedah. That would be really a remarkable thing, and it would set up an even bigger prize. The bigger prize would be that every time you find the ayil le'ola, that's really a way of channeling the theme of Akedas Yitzchak. The analog to that would be, as Chazal say, every time you have a cow as a sin offering, the par l'chatas, that's a reference back to the Akedas, that's a reference back to the Egel HaZahav. Okay, so that there would be a model for that. And then we just noted that the most interesting case of all might be the mystery ayil on Yom Kippur. There, it says that the Jewish people should bring an ayil on Yom Kippur, what's called the El Ha'am, the ram of the people. Now there's a machlokas, is this just merely the ram which appears in the context of the Korban Musaf? That's the way that we typically see it. Shitas Rabbi, the Gemara Yom Adaf Ayin. There's also Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Shimon, who says, no, it really was a separate ayil le'ola. But even according to Rebbe, this is a really interesting part, it's the only one of the Musaf offerings that's described in Acharei Mos. Right? All the other Musaf offerings, the seven sheep, and the cow, and the Seir Izim, are not mentioned explicitly in Acharei Mos. So what makes this the most important of the Musaf offerings? And we noted that it's actually offered at a different time of day, after all the Korbanos Musaf are offered, so this ayil sort of stands alone. If it's really true that the ayil le'ola is based on a different theme, if it's rooted in the Akedas Yitzchak, that might be the beginning of an explanation of why it's singled out. It has some kind of a different function, a different message. Okay. So what I just wanted to conclude with is in noting something that we really didn't spell out as much in the shiurim, but is actually, I think, the perfect ending to the whole story. You know, we started off by noting that the great test from Avram's point of view was that Avram had to make a dual sacrifice of his legacy. The moral sacrifice, again, what was his moral legacy going to be if he actually carried out the Akedah? Not much, right? You know, you could... you know, you can participate in as many charitable events as you want, but if you've committed the Akedah,
right? So then you've committed the akedah, number one. Number two, right, you know, obviously he would have been left with no descendants. And remember,
outside
we saw...
outside of Yishmael.
Right, but who had been banished. And you know, Kivi Yitzchak Yikari L'Chazara, the Rubicon had been crossed as far as, you know, Yishmael being a primary heir of Avram. So there's that great Medrash Rabbah that we saw where the Satan says to Avram, he says, look, you're going to kill your son, you'll be known as a murderer, and you'll have no descendants. And if you think, okay, God will bring you some other descendant, do you think that you're going to deserve it? You'll have been a murderer. You're just, your mind is playing games with you, that you're hearing voices. So Avram does it anyway. And there's this response that Avraham gets at the Akedah, after he goes through with offering the isle and he demonstrates his fidelity, that I haven't yet pointed out, but it strikes me as answers both of these issues. So Hashem says the following, Ki varecha varechacha, you will surely be blessed, viharba arbe zaracha. Not only will you have one descendant, but your descendants truly will be numerous. Viharba bar zaracha kechve ha-shamayim v'chachol asher el svas hayam, the stars in the heaven and the sand on the beaches. So that you will be blessed. Ki v'yitzchak yikari l'chazar, that aspect is being addressed explicitly. But not only that, but Avram's concern, what I would call the moral legacy, not in a selfish way, like, oh, what will people think of me, but will his place in the world truly have been a blessing for humanity? This is something that we were discussing before the Chabur a few weeks ago, in terms of the blessing that Jews have brought to humanity, and the sciences, medicine, etc. So Avram's concern, will I be a force for good or not? So Hashem says explicitly, that the whole world, it won't just be a selfish thing, that you'll become very numerous, but your descendants will become the ultimate source of blessing for all of humanity. Right? That's a message that's conveyed in the wake of the Akedah. Avram, I know you were concerned that your any contribution you had made to humanity, and to, when I say humanity, I just mean to a group of individuals that you encountered, but a legacy of chesed, a legacy of tzelem elokim, that will be reinforced. But that also sets up a very, a kind of very stark line of demarcation, because it does become a kind of in us versus them. At the same moment that Avram is told, because you've demonstrated this incredible fidelity to me, I will channel blessing through your descendants to the world over. At the same time, Avram is told, that your descendants will ultimately win victory over their enemies. That there is, the Jewish people become a kind of, what we might call like a lightning rod, today. In other words, those who support them and those who rally to them will be blessed through the Jewish people. Those who abandon them, and even worse, right, become their enemies, will ultimately be defeated. V'yirash zaracha, your zera, will ultimately inherit es sha'ar oivav, their enemies. Meaning that the Akedah, Avram's loyalty that he demonstrates at the Akedah, means that whoever signs on to the message of the Akedah, to, you know, God-fearing behavior in the model, in the mold of Avram Avinu, will ultimately merit the blessing of Avram's descendants. They will be blessed through Avram's descendants, as the Torah says explicitly, V'sparachu v'zaracha kol goyei haaretz. Your zera, your descendants, will become the mechanism, the method, the means through which people of the earth are blessed. But at the same time, those who stand against that message, who reject what Avram did at the Akedah, v'yirash zaracha ishar oivav. Your zera will inherit, ultimately, those who are their enemies. So that everybody has a choice to make. In other words, the nations of the world have a choice to make. Do they ultimately endorse, doesn't mean they have to do the same thing, but do they endorse the type of fidelity to God that Avram demonstrated at the Akedah, or do they stand against that message? The choice that they make regarding that point, the choice that they make regarding how they view the Akedah, will ultimately determine whether they will be blessed or whether they will be destroyed. So that when it comes to the Akedah, nobody can stand fully neutral.
the Akedah was very much a personal experience for Avram and Yitzchak, but how one evaluates what happened is ultimately a question that everybody has to address, not just the Jewish people, but it becomes a question for Kol Goyei Haaretz. It becomes literally an international historical event. So this is the.
How do you get from? I mean, how does that happen? How does that? How does the idea of whether you're an Oyvav or not root itself back to your view of the Akedah?
Only because at the Akedah itself, this message is given to Avram. Is that there's this very striking formula in the Pesukim where it says, "Ekev Asher Shamata Bikoli." Now that you've achieved this. You've achieved this incredible stature, so those who rally to you will ultimately be blessed, and those who are your enemies will ultimately be defeated, because you've achieved Ekev Asher Shamata Bekoli Velo Chasachta Spinchas Yechidecha, because you've achieved this kind of ultimate identification with me, God says, you are now my unquestioned servant here on this earth. You represent me fully. Atayadati Kirei Elokimata. So because your legacy is inextricably linked with the Akedah, the choice that people make about aligning themselves with you or opposing you will now have utter consequences for them.
Well, how do you carve, say, Esav out? Let's say Yishmael is sort of easy, but you know, Esav is Zerah Yaakov through Yitzchak too, right?
Right, but remember that whenever the term Zerah is used, it's only a reference to Yitzchak. Ki v'Yitzchak yikare l'cha Zara. So that, in other words, when you talk about Avram being an Av Hamon Goyim, that will include everybody. But when you talk about the Zerah Avraham, that only refers to the descendants of Yitzchak.
Right, that's why I asked about Esav, not Yishmael.
Right.
Esav is an ascendant of Yitzchak.
Right, but the question is, who is the ultimate descendant of Yitzchak?
Well, so that's another step you have to take, though, and why does that, how do you, I mean, you almost have to retro
that
step to this.
Well, what I would say is that probably goes back to the Hineni point, because remember that we said each one, Yaakov and Esav, both say Hineni. They're both saying, I am the rightful heir of Avram, but only Yaakov ultimately gets that, because remember at the end of Parshas Toldos, Yitzchak says to Yaakov, "Vitein lechas berkas Avraham." Avram's blessing now is squarely in your court, your domain. And that's the, and it's only channeled through Yaakov.
So Yitzchak is basically deciding who his Zera is for this purpose.
Yitzchak gets to.
It's a branching point.
Correct. Whereas Yaakov does not have that branching point. Even though the drama amongst Yaakov's own sons is that they presume that there will be a branching point, that it's Yosef or Yehuda. The chiddush, so to speak, of Yaakov's life is that he doesn't have to choose the way that Avram had to choose and Yitzchak had to choose. There was no reason that he would have thought that. There's no advance information that he has to that,
right,
to that point. Okay. So, if there are any outstanding issues, I guess we can circle back to them tomorrow at the beginning, and then we'll just have.